2012, January 11th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 7, The Biological Revolution and the Nature of Life. In our continuing series on five revolutions that set the stage for this question of, is there life on other worlds, we've seen a couple that have very definitive answers. The Copernican Revolution told us where we are in the solar system. The Chemical Revolution told us what the nature of matter was. In fact, some of the most precise measurements we can make in all of physics and chemistry are in the atomic world, believe it or not. Finally, the geological revolution yesterday, we actually could put a fairly precise of order 1% age on the Earth, and we can learn techniques that are going to be useful to us in trying to unravel the Earth's history. We can ask pretty definitive questions and get pretty definite answers. But in this one particular question we're going to take up today, the nature of life, the answers are a little fuzzier, the shadows are a little darker, and the reason is largely because life is much more complicated. It's a complex biochemical system and physical system, and it really defies asking simple questions and getting simple quantitative answers. So it's not too surprising that of all the revolutions we're going to be looking at, the biological revolution is one that in many ways is still ongoing. But today we're going to take an historical approach and look at how we got to where we are today, and then we'll begin to elaborate that modern view through various lectures as we begin to address the question of life on Earth. Particularly, what today we're going to do is we're going to talk about how we came to our modern view of biology. What is the historical path behind it, and what are some of the ideas there? And in particular, I'm going to pick as an illustrative point today the idea of this long persistence of this really ancient notion of spontaneous generation for the origin of life. The idea that life somehow came from non-life. This was a very difficult notion to root out. In fact, it remained all the way into the 19th century, long after just about every other Aristotelian idea had long since fallen by the wayside. We're going to see again, once again, how invention of new technologies often leads to great advances and great moving forward in our understanding of various questions in science. And for biology, it's going to be the invention of the microscope. The microscope is going to be to biology what Galileo's telescope was to astronomy. It extended our view now to the world of the very small and began its essential tool, just like telescopes are in astronomy, to understanding the nature of life, because most life on this planet, and we suspect perhaps elsewhere, is microscopic in nature. It's too small to be seen by the unaided eye. One of the persistent problems of biology, one of the things that really dogged it for a long time, is this whole question of heredity. How is it that traits are passed on from parents to their offspring? Getting at this answer turns out to have required us getting down right down to the molecular level and brings us up to modern biology. So once you got past the nature of what is life and got rid of the idea of spontaneous generation, the big problem in life turns out to be the problem of heredity. And it's taken us a long time, well into the middle of the 20th century, before we've come to our modern view that heredity, the agents of heredity, are genes and DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, as being the molecular agents for heredity that passes on traits from parents to offspring. This is going to be very important to us because it really changes the character of the study of life from a largely, you know, descriptive science into one that actually is capable of making testable predictions. And in particular, it leads to the whole area of biochemistry, this merging between biology and chemistry, the idea that life is a physical system, which means it's subject to expressible as basic scientific principles and can make testable hypotheses. And that's very important to us when we begin to sort of make the leap from life on Earth and understanding the nature of life on Earth to applying that knowledge to the question of life elsewhere in the universe. Well, it's interesting that just about every lecture I could come up with on the various revolutions in science that have led us to the modern world, Aristotle always seems to pop up. Aristotle wrote a great deal in the 3rd century BC. He had an opinion about just about everything. In fact, probably the only thing he didn't write were the words, "I don't know," or whatever their equivalent in Attic Greek was. He seemed to know virtually everything, and he wrote it down. And because his works were so definitively written, he was so authoritative, that it came down and spent many centuries, he was the go-to authority on just about everything. ethics, astronomy, physics, biology, the nature of matter, you name it, Aristotle had an opinion and wrote a book about it, which survived from antiquity into the modern age. And so, too, is going to be the case in biology. Aristotle was highly influential well into the Renaissance. In fact, one would argue he was relevant and actually influential well into the 19th century, long after every other Aristotelian idea had fallen by the wayside. In particular, one idea of Aristotle's, or at least it probably wasn't original to Aristotle, but it was his classical expression of it that comes down to us, is this idea of spontaneous generation. The idea that life arises from non-living matter in some way. It comes to us primarily through one book. It was his History of Animals, which is a wonderful book to read for just an amazing view of just how amazingly wrong he could be about so many different things. But one of the ideas that stuck was the idea that certain animals, in fact, he thought maybe all animals, were spontaneously generated either from putrefying earth or vegetable matter. So basically, life came out of rotting things. This is not a completely crazy notion in some sense. After all, if you find something that's rotting, it probably is crawling with some pretty nasty-looking things. Maggots, flies, things like that. And so it's almost a common sense notion, but once you dig down through the surface of it, it really maybe doesn't make sense or maybe does. It took us a long time to really unsort this. And this idea was really influential. It stuck for a very long time, even in the Renaissance. No less an author than William Shakespeare in Antony and Cleopatra repeats an idea of spontaneous generation. He puts it into one of his characters' mouth. Your serpent of Egypt is bred now of your mud by the operation of your son. So is your crocodile. The idea that putrefying mud and vegetable matter with the sunlight falling upon it brought forth snakes and crocodiles from within. And this was taken very seriously, even at an experimental level. But as we began to get into the Newtonian world, into the world of the Renaissance, when Aristotle was shown to be so incorrect about so many things, people began to do experiments and actually ask the questions for themselves, to go beyond the simple authority, and began to address this question of spontaneous generation. There was one really beautiful classical experiment that was done in the year 1668 by the Italian biologist Francesco Redi. He argued very strongly against spontaneous generation with a very simple experiment. If you just took a piece of meat, raw meat, and set it out on a table and kind of left it there for a while, pretty soon flies are attracted to it and eventually maggots start forming in it. It's really pretty gross. This day and age of refrigeration, we don't see this very often, but in the Renaissance, where they didn't know much about refrigeration, it was a common problem, the idea of sort of rot. And the idea was out of this rot or putrefying meat was where maggots actually sprung. Sunlight or air falling upon it brought them forth spontaneously. So Francesco Redi did a very simple experiment. He took three jars. He put a sample of meat in each one. It was fresh, so he cut it off of some animal. I don't remember if he used beef or pork or chicken. He used something like that. Put it in three completely clean bottles. One of those bottles was left open to the air, the one here in the middle in the sketch. Another, he simply put a stopper, cork, into it so that no air from the outside could get in. And in the third, he put a very simple piece of gauzy cloth across the top so that air could actually get through the cloth in and out of the bottle. What happened was the meat in the open jar very quickly began to rot, putrefy, and maggots began to appear. When the maggots appeared, they eventually hatched into flies that flew out of the bottle. It was probably a pretty nasty experiment to be in the same room with. In the bottle that sealed up, the meat was in the tightly jar. It, too, began to rot and putrefy because it was unrefrigerated. They didn't know about the action of microbes, basically bacteria, but no maggots appeared. No flies appeared, nothing. It just sat in the bottom of the jar and rotted. In the container, which had the gauze sheet on top of it, the smell getting through the gauze very quickly attracted every fly in the neighborhood that wasn't on the open jar, but no maggots ever appeared. So what Redi was able to conclude from this was that he only got maggots when it was open to the air, so not only air could get in, but flies could get in. If you closed it off to the air, it still rotted, but no maggots. If you let the air pass through, the other possible agency, but kept the flies out, you rotted, but you got no maggots. So the idea was that the flies are actually begetting the maggots, which in turn beget the flies, which develop into maggots, and so forth. but they weren't being spontaneously generated. You got buried in this a kind of a classic chicken or egg problem. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Or in this problem, which comes first, the maggot or the fly? It doesn't get at the question of origin so much. Okay, where was the first egg? Or, you know, getting into those nasty philosophical questions which can just get us into trouble. Instead, what he was showing was it wasn't, in fact, the air or the sunlight that was the agency of generation of maggots. It was there are other flies. The flies are coming in, perhaps laying eggs. These eggs are too small to see. But whenever the flies got onto the meat visibly, maggots would appear within a few, you know, a couple days. Of course, what Reddy could not see is the eggs of the flies are nearly microscopic. He simply couldn't see them. So this should have been a very powerful counter-experiment to really get rid of this idea of spontaneous generation. But it was interesting that it wasn't. And here's an example. There's many experiments that went back and forth through the 17th, 18th, and even into the 19th century, where there was experiment and counter-experiment, which would either show that, oh yes, spontaneous generation works, or no, it doesn't. It wasn't a settled experimental problem. I'll give one example here of a counter-example. A man by the name of Félix Pouchet, he was working in the mid-19th century, he was a Frenchman, did a very famous experiment in favor of spontaneous generation. It began to be understood fairly early on that the way you stopped things from rotting or putrefying was to cook them. Right? A piece of cooked meat would take a lot longer to rot than a piece of raw meat. Or if you boiled something and boiled the hell out of it, it wouldn't go bad. It wouldn't sour, it wouldn't ferment, it wouldn't start growing green, icky mold on it. So they started understanding this idea of boiling things to sterilize them. So what he did was he took hay, which is pretty nasty stuff if you think where hay is usually found. It's out in the open, it's covered with spores and mold. Sometimes it's at the bottom of a barn, so it's in contact with even nastier stuff. But he boiled the hell out of it to sterilize it, to kill all forms of life he could think of in there. Now, what he then did was put it into a sealed vessel, but rather than exposing it to outside air, people understood that oxygen had something to do with life. So the discovery of oxygen and its relationship to life. The classic experiments where you pump the air out of a jar which has birds in it. If you don't provide them with oxygen, if you put in carbon dioxide or something, they suffocate. But if you provide oxygen to the bottle, the birds live. So people knew that oxygen had something to do with life. So what Boucher did was to make his own oxygen. It was well known by putting an electric current through water that you would break the water into hydrogen and oxygen. And oxygen could then be sent into the vessel where he had put the sterilized hay. So he provided it with pure air, pure oxygen, untainted by anything that might be floating around in the air, like mold spores or yeast spores or something else. Not surprisingly, very soon thereafter, inside of his sealed jar that he'd been pumping fresh oxygen into, mold started to appear. There actually started to be fermentation and life growing in this supposedly sterilized hay. And this was a very strong experiment. It was done very nicely. Everything seemed to be good about it. And it really called into question, maybe spontaneous generation does occur, although now the organisms it's occurring in are more microscopic organisms. And so this actually this is one of many experiments that kind of set back the clock a little bit as the question went back and forth to and fro. But we're dealing with life here, not chemical atomic processes, not astronomy where you can make fairly repeatable observations. You're dealing with this complex system of life. And the problem of biological experiments, if any of you work in a biological lab, know that controls and cleanliness are all of the game. And in fact, what happened to Pouchet is he didn't know that he was dealing with heat-resistant spores. There are actually spores, there are forms of life, and we're going to meet them elsewhere, that can actually stand up to some really extreme conditions. You can boil some spores and they will actually survive. Maybe you've got to boil them longer, maybe you've got to boil them with a little bit of alcohol added. You've got to really work hard to kill them. Pouchet basically just didn't have adequate experimental controls. But you couldn't tell from the time, because again, people didn't know about heat-resistant spores. This is a hard experiment. These people are serious scientists, they're not cranks. And this is an idea which is very persistent. But the final death a spontaneous generation, belongs to a man who all of you have probably heard of, at least through even grade school science, is Louis Pasteur, the inventor of pasteurization, the person who first understood fermentation chemistry and the use of yeast in fermentation, which is a big deal in France, where one of the main industries is winemaking, which relies on yeast fermentation. And he had actually done a series of experiments following on Pouchet and others that really definitively showed that spontaneous generation simply didn't work. You make up a nutrient broth, which is, you just leave a nutrient broth out, yeast spores, bacteria get into it, and poof, the thing just starts fermenting like crazy, almost spontaneously. And they sealed them up in these very beautiful glass vessels. So there was one entrance vessel here that you would fill the main ball with, and then you would seal it off by basically heating the glass until you closed it off. And then he allowed air in, but he allowed air in through a very, very long, thin point here. He boiled one to sterilize it, pasteurizing it, and did not boil the other. So he didn't kill the organisms within. This long, thin glass tube here keeps airborne yeasts out. Basically, the passage is too small. It will let oxygen and other molecules through, but yeast spores are big, and they won't make it through the neck of this. What he found was that the unboiled broth fermented like that. Just overnight, pretty soon the thing is a bubbling green, nasty smelling mess. But the one that was sealed off was not. It was boiled, sterilized, it didn't generate anything. Nothing got in. The only way he could make this do anything, and it lasted for days upon days upon days, was to break off the end of the glass tube, reopen the seal, and then, if you will, inoculate it with the yeast that had accumulated in the end of the glass tube. And when he did that, boom, immediate fermentation. There were two pieces of this. One was to show that yeast was the agency of fermentation, and the second was basically to completely deny this whole idea of spontaneous generation. He repeated Pouchet's experiment, but under much, much more controlled conditions. He used a nutrient broth that should not contain heat-resistant spores. He knew something a little bit about heat resistance at that point. He had come up with better protocols for sterilization, better than Pouchet's. In fact, that protocol for heat sterilization is what we call pasteurization. He knew that it not only took heat, but heat and time. And so this was a very beautiful, definitive experiment. But it's worth pointing out, this is 1859. The idea of spontaneous generation was taken seriously till the middle of the 19th century. It's an illustration, first, of the persistence of ideas that seem semi-common sense, and second, an illustration of how really much harder biology is in many ways than many of the physical sciences. Your controls have to be tighter. The systems are actually intrinsically far more complicated. It's really hard to draw conclusions without a great deal of care. And that's something we're going to see over and over again, as biology still surprises us to this day. Even more so, I think, in many ways, than almost any other field. There's sort of a mystery about life that seems to pervade this whole topic that both gets in the way and is kind of a humbling reminder that we got a long ways to go to understanding things. One of the ways in which our understanding was pushed forward was a technological advance. It became very clear to people that life was not just simply the big macroscopic life we see around us. There were other agencies within the world that seemed to act upon living organisms. Diseases are a good example. Water, for example, seemed to be that you could drink some water and you'd be perfectly fine. You drink other water and you're in bad, bad shape. It's coming out both ends if you drink the wrong stuff. So what was the difference? Water was water, right? Maybe not. Maybe there was something in the water. But what was it? You couldn't see anything. Well, okay, it was obvious if the water had pond scum on it, but if you to take clean water, sometimes it was healthy, sometimes it was not, and people couldn't understand why. So people began to use the new science of optics, but in particular, it was one man by the name of a Dutchman by the name of Anton van Leeuwenhoek, who built, if you will, an inverse telescope, a device meant to see the things that are very small instead of the things that are very large. This is van Leeuwenhoek's original microscope. It consists of one very, very strong lens and a little sample-holding device that can sit in the front that can be affixed with a clamp, and then a device for simply focusing this. And you held it up to your eye, And I've used, in fact, a replica of Van Leeuwenhoek's microscope, and it's exceedingly difficult to use. And so Van Leeuwenhoek's success with the microscope is really, in many ways, a testament to his stick-to-itiveness in this very hard-to-use instrument. It was not too surprising that after the invention of the microscope by Van Leeuwenhoek, that people began to refine the design. If you look at a modern microscope, it looks a lot like a backwards Galilean telescope. And optically speaking, that's kind of what it is. It's showing you the things at the eyepiece end rather than at the objective end, like a regular astronomical telescope. What the microscope allowed us to do very quickly was to see things smaller than could be seen by the very limited vision that we have with the human eye. And immediately, people began to find that the world was teeming with microscopic life that was not otherwise evident. For example, this led directly to the discovery of cells. Even in macroscopic creatures like our cells, we have distinguishable tissues, but when you look carefully at those tissues, you see that those tissues resolve very quickly into repeated cells, units that they're built, structural units that the tissues are built up of. And liver cells look different than skin cells, look different than stomach cells, and so forth. So you began to begin to see that different parts of a human body or an animal body were made of different units, and those units all were replicated. That was an important clue as to what's going on. It was shown, for example, that flies and these other small insects actually did lay eggs. They didn't pop spontaneously out of the mud. It's just their eggs were just too small to see. They were little tiny transparent things. Only if you occasionally would get an egg mass, like you get with some moths, would kind of get clued into that. But every small insect had eggs. And those eggs, when you collected them up and put them together, hatched into larvae, maggots if you're a fly, and eventually became a fly or another copy of the small insect. Furthermore, what it really led to was the discovery of the microorganisms, the microscopic world. And there people got kind of a shock to their system. Just like when Galileo turned his telescope to the sky, people began to see things in the sky that you could not see with the naked eye. We can see maybe 6,000 stars with the unaided eye, but suddenly we saw like the Milky Way, the sort of band of white light, was made up of millions of invisible stars. There were far more stars than the human eye, we could see from the Earth. So true it became when Leeuwenhoek's microscope and its successors was turned on the microscopic world. All of a sudden, that little drop of apparently clear water was teeming with so many different forms of life. People began to quickly do the math and realize there were more forms of microscopic life than there were people, animals, trees, and the big things we see around us every day. We are literally, even though we have a very high opinion of ourselves as the pinnacle of evolution, we're just the tip of the iceberg of life on Earth. Most of the life on this planet is microorganisms. And that was a real shock to people's systems. Why would most of the creation be little tiny things we can't see, some of which actually probably can be pathogenic and kill us? Here's some examples of some of the things we're seeing. This is on the left. This is actually a woodcut from Van Leeuwenhoek's book showing some of the microscopic organisms he found out in the canals of near his home. Showing that, in fact, supposedly clear water was, in fact, full of all kinds of wonderful things called rotifers. And these were extremely complicated little beasties. They had organs, just like much larger creatures. There was a whole microscopic world that was replicated in detail. But, you know, you didn't find little people, but you found complex things. You found tissue organs, and ultimately, many years later, people found cells. Even familiar creatures like the flea. This is a beautiful piece, Hooke, the famous British astronomer, mathematician, physicist, and an all-around really smart guy, built a beautifully refined microscope and studied fleas and found, in fact, fleas were as complex as any large-scale creature like a cow or a sheep. So again, I think that the bottom line here is Van Leeuwenhoek's microscope was truly revolutionary in its scale. It is to biology what Galileo's telescope is to astronomy. It revealed a wholly unseen world to us and began to let us really get down and seeing what, if you will, the machinery of life actually looks like, at least part of that machinery of life. But it wasn't the entire answer. It certainly was going to be one of the primary tools that's going to be used, but there was another problem in life. Get around this whole idea of spontaneous generation, where does life come from? You have to also get around a key observation about life. Why is it that offspring look like their parents? This sounds like a really simple, well, of course, that's because they're their parents. But how is it characteristics can be passed down from parents to another? So I've got one picture here which is showing four generations of the British royal family. That's Queen Victoria there in the middle, being, as usually for Queen Vicky, she was unamused by her great-grandchild there, her grandson and her son. Various traits can come down through families. There are family resemblances. You look like your siblings. You look like one or both of your parents, if you're your biological parents, certainly. And there's a question about how these traits are transmitted. Why is it spotted cows almost always lead to spotted cows? Why don't spotted cows suddenly become pure brown cows? Sometimes they do, and that really freaked people out. But for the most part, spotted cows lead to spotted cows, lead to spotted cows. And you could then play games. You could take a spotted cow that had a bigger white spot than other spotted cows, and you could selectively breed those so that you ended up with herds full of all white cows eventually, or something like that. You could actually selectively breed plants and animals for particular traits. You had no idea what the hell the method of transmission was, but you knew if you did it through enough generations, it would kind of work. But no one really understood how. And there were a number of ideas. The first of these is the most obvious. This idea of what's called blending inheritance. That basically both the parents mix together and you kind of average things out. Okay, so if you take brown cows and white cows, maybe you get kind of a brown and white cow after a few generations. The idea of acquired inheritance, that individual traits are somehow enhanced by the parents. And this led to the idea that not only biological traits, you know, skin color, eye color, hair color, whether your bodies are big or small, tall, lanky, short, whatever, but actually things like, you know, personality tics could somehow be transmitted down from the parents. No one knew the agency, but that was one idea. And the other crazier idea was something which actually had a lot of currency for a long time, called pangenesis. Pangenesis was that somehow the body shed cells, and these cells were gathered together in your body in some place, and they became the origin of the sex cells. So various parts of your body would get aggregated together, and the sex cells were kind of this odd aggregation of things called gemmules, which you then, you know, shared with your spouse, and the outcome was some combination of those, either picking up acquiring or simply blending inheritance. But it's a big problem. First of all, understanding the systematics requires the development of things like statistics. There was no mathematical language for talking about probabilities and statistics before about the, you know, in the early portions of the late 18th, early 19th centuries. And it really wasn't as well developed as it is until today in many ways. The second problem was trying to understand what the agency of this is and actually getting at the systematics of inheritance. So one idea, for example, that people thought of for how traits are passed down from parents to offspring was this idea that came out of a trying to understand human sexual reproduction, something called the homunculus. This was actually an old idea. It was pre-microscopic. But when first people got the first microscopes going, they thought they could see structures buried within various cells. And in fact, what they looked at were male sperm cells. And their microscopes were pretty good, but sperm cells are really tiny. And what they thought they saw was there's kind of a head and a tail here. There is a head and a tail. Well, actually, there's a main nucleus, body, and a tail. But they saw a head and a tail, and very fancifully, they began to think of, well, what you've got is a little human being kind of all curled up inside the head of the sperm cell called the homunculus, the little human. It was a complete copy of a human being. All you had to do was get it into an appropriate medium, a female uterus, and it would then develop into a full-size human being. Now, this was actually abetted by the microscope, by having, you know, pretty poor optics, and, well, you know, it's kind of hard to look at these things when they're really small and wriggling around, but people began to sort of see what they wanted to see. And there's a fellow by the name of von Hartsucker, who in 1694, very shortly after the invention of the microscope, put forward this idea of the homunculus. And it caught on really quickly. People kind of could see the same thing von Hartsucker was going to see. Hartsucker and said, well, maybe this is an idea. But they started twigging to the problems, this idea. Okay, sperm are only found in men. So why do your children also resemble mom? Isn't that kind of a problem? If everything's buried in there, why do they not just look like dad? So there was a common sense observation that made people think, yeah, this can't quite be right. The other problem was the problem of infinite regress. See, they didn't understand how some cells could split, divide, and form other cells. The notion of growth was not understood. So in the ultimate expression of the homunculus theory, buried inside the homunculus, if the homunculus was a male, were copies of sperm cells which were themselves homunculi, which themselves contained sperm cells of their male, which were homunculi, and pretty soon you got homunculi all the way down. This begets the problem of infinite regress. How do you make structures that small? And at what point do they stop? When do you run into the atoms? When do you run into the indivisible level? And if you do run into an indivisible level, that tells you the number of generations you can possibly go before you run out of homunculi. So there's some real problems here. But it's surprising that with all those problems, this idea stuck for a long time because no one really was able to understand the agency of sexual reproduction. Well, one of the real key experiments or series of experiments that sort of began to get at systematics, actually put on a firm empirical basis this idea of heredity, rather than being this haphazard bit of folklore and breeding and, oh yeah, okay, you know, you get those two sheep together and you get a sheep of a different color and you just keep playing the game of culling out the black ones and pretty soon you get all black sheep or something. It didn't always work that way and it was very hit or miss, but people began to study this systematically and apply the same kind of precision, sort of a quantitative precision they could as much as possible to life studies as they did and were gaining from the same time with studies of things like chemistry and physics and astronomy. And in particular, one of the most elegant series of experiments was done by Gregor Mendel. Gregor Mendel was a Roman Catholic priest. He was working in Austria, pretty much far from everybody. He didn't publish much in his lifetime, or certainly published in very obscure journals, so his work was initially lost. But one of the things they had at the rectory where they lived was they had a garden, and Gregor had a thing for peas. He liked garden peas. And he noticed that various hereditary traits from the various peas, whether you ended up with violet flowers or white flowers, whether you had big round peas or little tiny shriveled peas, the shapes and colors of the pea pods, whether they were smooth or wrinkled, green or yellow, that all of these traits would come and go with the different types of peas. But by very carefully crossbreeding the peas, getting the pollen from one pea flower and putting it on another, he found, through careful systematic study over many years, that all of these hereditary factors were not random. They always came in pairs. There was never one factor that would kind of work its way through. It always worked in concert with some other factor. Furthermore, he recognized that when you take those two factors, they weren't equal. Sometimes one factor was dominant. If that factor was present, then that factor's trait was always going to appear in the offspring. Whereas there was the other trait, the other factor, he called recessive. If it was a dominant and a recessive, the dominant would win. Dominant, dominant, well, that one's obvious. You would only get the recessive trait come through the offspring if there were two recessives together and no dominant anywhere in sight. So what Gregor had tripped across was part of the piece of the puzzle of sexual reproduction, that it takes two to tango, not just simply at the macroscopic level of male and female, but also at the level of the at the molecular level as well. Here is an example using flowers. Now, there are many, many traits that Mendel was able to show this was not just flowers. But let's take this. So let's take two parents, a purple flower, which has this dominant trait. The dominant trait for a purple flower we'll call big P. Big capital letter tells me it's dominant, P for purple. And then there's a recessive trait, W for white. So we'll take two pure parents, a pure dominant parent, purple, purple, and a pure recessive parent, white, white, which is the only form of the white flower. And then we cross them, and they make offspring. There are four possible combinations that you can get sharing one trait from the parent A and one trait from parent B. When you have dominant, dominant against recessive, recessive, you have four possible outcomes. Dominant, recessive, dominant, recessive, dominant, recessive, dominant, recessive. Since the dominant is the purple flower, all of the offspring have purple flowers. Now you take from a different lineage, different line, another hybrid dominant, recessive, purple flower, and you cross them, and you make a second generation. Now in generation two, there are four combinations. You have dominant, dominant, because you can get a big P from each, or you can get dominant, recessive, dominant recessive, so you get a pair of those, or recessive recessive. And all of a sudden, the white flower offspring skips a generation in this particular case. Well, this is only showing two of the branches. You do this relentlessly with very careful controls, and you follow through generation after generation. You can very quickly identify these pairs of dominant and recessive traits. And you can see how things can roll through a family. For example, a particular family trait, maybe a genetically transmitted disease, might skip multiple generations and then suddenly show up in a great-grandson. How does that happen? It's because there are pairs of traits, pairs of factors, passed on from one parent and another, and it's the mixing of those factors that leads to heredity. So Gregor Mendel was able to see the mathematical, the statistical nature of this and identify some of those traits. But what he could not do was identify the agency that carried those traits and carry it further as how is it? What is a dominant and what is a recessive and what makes it? He didn't know what that was. Nor did he fully understand how it was those were transmitted through the pollen and receptors in the plants. So the next set of experiments was to be pushed forward by microscopic experiments. For example, when you use the microscope to follow generations that can flourish pretty quickly and actually grow pretty rapidly, sea urchins turn out to be really good. Sea urchins are great because they have gigantic egg cells. And as a consequence, you can see pretty clearly the factors that come together when the sperm cell gets together with the egg cell. You can dye them different colors, and you can see, there's one part of the package just delivered by the sperm cell, which is labeled here in green. The nucleus over here of the cell is dyed in purple, and you can see that these two eventually get together and merge, and when they merge, all of a sudden, this passive egg cell starts dividing, and before long, you get a sea urchin. So by watching what were the changes in the egg cell, what was it the sperm coming from the sperm cell to the egg cell that came together, made people realize that the hereditary factors that were passed on at the cellular level resided in the cell nucleus. They resided in this very central cluster of dark stuff. They didn't know what that stuff was, but it was dark stuff buried deep in the center of the cell. All the other bits of the cell were various pieces of cell machinery didn't seem to have a thing to do with heredity. So the hereditary factors were being carried by the nucleus. That was an important clue from microscopic studies. The next step came with much more powerful microscopes and the application of certain types of chemical dyes that could change the color of certain cells, certain cell pieces, certain molecules and structures within cells a different color and leave other structures alone, so you would make them stand out. In particular, Walther Fleming, working in the late 19th century, came up with a very nice series of dyes that would cause these structures, these thread-like structures, to suddenly pop out in the middle of cell nuclei. Because they carried some color, they referred to those, people had seen them before, they were called chromosomes. And what Walther was able to do was use a form of these dyes that didn't poison the cell and kill it, which kind of stops your experiment cold, but found a form of the dye that was benign to the cell, that wouldn't damage it, and then watched through the microscope as these cells began their process of division. And what he saw was that the structures, these chromosome structures deep inside the cell, combined, replicated, and then split into two halves. So you could see how a cell, just a regular cell, we're not even talking about sexual reproduction here, just watching like skin cells or other cells within a replicating body, suddenly replicate themselves, double the system, and then the two pull apart and you end up with two copies of the same thing. Of course, sometimes they're imperfect copies and one piece gets a different piece than another. He called this process mitosis. Now, what he did not know was that the hereditary factors are residing inside these chromosomes. He only knew that something was being divided up between them, but he didn't know what these chromosomes were made of. All he knew is that in the cell division process, the chromosomes played a key role. The chromosomes getting together, doing their thing, and splitting was clearly part of the machinery of division. It really came in the early 20th century, some beautiful experiments at Columbia by Thomas Hunt Morgan, who was using a rapidly growing, much larger animal, the fruit fly, where there they could grow so many generations so quickly, you could begin to tag the chromosomes for certain sex-specific traits. If you will, the X and Y chromosome division, for example, in humans, is replicated in some degree to the X and Y to the chromosomal differences between male and female Drosophila flies. He could then tag these differences and watch how those differences are divided among the Drosophila lines. And you can see here various diagrams where he shows two traits and one of the traits coming in with the female line, the white cell, how those get divided up into multiple generations. The white line here is what gives you a white-eyed fly. And you see exactly that dark-eyed fly, ooh, recessive white-eyed fly appears in subsequent generations. But by being able to tag those within the chromosomes of the cells themselves, he was able to, number one, identify that the chromosomes were the carrier of genetic or heredity information, and in fact were the site of these hereditary factors which came to be known at that time as genes. So it was through a series of microscopic experiments having to be done with relatively rapidly growing animals, you could get multiple generations of very quickly, that happened to be creatures for which there are lots and lots of mutated versions, so the differences, the dominant and recessive versions, are very obvious. Okay, if there are subtle differences from generation to generation, it's going to be hard. So you pick things where it's pretty obvious. Purple flowers versus white. Black eyes or red eyes versus white. Things that just sort of get in your face that, oh, this is a creature which is carrying two of the recessive traits. It's got to be obvious. So the trick is being able to do this, do it in a controlled fashion, and do it very, very systematically. So people began to narrow it down. The agencies of heredity, the sharing between the two parents to the offspring appears to be in the nucleus. Inside the nucleus, those agencies seem to be the chromosomes. Those are the carriers of heredity. Okay, what are the chromosomes? What are the chromosomes made of? And the answer to that didn't come until the 1950s. It was a famous series of experiments by Watson and Crick that was to show that what the chromosomes are extremely long strands of one of the largest molecules ever known, deoxyribonucleic acid. But deoxyribonucleic acid, you say, well, it's just a molecule, but what's important about it is its structure. It's got this double helix structure. We're going to go into more detail about the structure of DNA and how it is the agency of heredity in a later lecture. It deserves its own topic and is essential to understanding how life works at this level. But what was important about DNA is you've taken something fairly mysterious, passing down of heredity from parents to offspring, the fact that certain recessive traits can skip multiple generations and then suddenly appear where they shouldn't be otherwise. The idea of blending. How does that work? What is being passed and how does it pass? And was able to get it right down to the level of molecular instructions. What a DNA is basically a series of molecular instructions for making proteins inside of cells. In the exact structure of the DNA, that series of instructions is what's carried in the chromosome. So when a male and female put their generative cells together to form a new offspring, half of the DNA comes from the mother, half of the DNA comes from the father, and it gets blended. And how these blend together and then express themselves as traits in the offspring is the entire mechanism and machinery of heredity. So life ultimately comes down. One of the basic expressions of life is the ability to reproduce and pass on traits down to one's offspring. This is the machinery by which it happens. So we go from not knowing whether flies bounce spontaneously out of rotted meat to understanding life at the molecular level. This is a tremendous revolution in thought because it takes biology out of this range in life, out of this range of mystery. It still has some mystery about it, but it makes it very different. In particular, with the outcome of the biological revolution, a revolution which is still going on today, is to say that life isn't so mysterious. It's a physical phenomenon. It's governed by understandable laws, although I don't think any biologist would say we understand all of those laws yet. We are making good progress on that. And that as a consequence of being describable in terms of understandable laws, we can make predictions as to how living systems will actually behave, and those predictions are testable. So it really turns it into a form of science. The implications are still with us today. We're still playing out a lot of the understanding of how life works, and there's still an awful lot to be learned. My hat goes off to the people who went into the biological fields when I was in college. It's exploded in the last decade or so. Our understanding is getting deeper and deeper, and it's beginning to inform the question of what is life and how life works is surprising us every day. There's tremendous advances have been made, particularly in the areas of molecular genetics and molecular biology is where most of this focus is. And we're going to be looking at some of those advances over lectures coming up in this course when we talk about life on Earth, starting with the lectures that begin on Friday, because this is going to be essential to understanding this question of what the nature of life is, because it sets the requirements for life. So if we're going to be going and looking for life elsewhere in the universe, we really need to understand how it works. We need to be able to ask is, what is life, in order for us to know where to go looking for it? So the biological revolution is absolutely essential to setting the stage for astrobiology. Any questions? Okay. In that case, I will see you all tomorrow.